Hi there, I'm Alistair Madden and you're listening to Season 4, Episode 19 of the Road to Nowhere European Football Podcast. In this episode, we presented our traditional end of season awards, or rather our alternative end of season awards, and in dishing out those alternative end of season awards, we looked at the Basque Country's disproportionate impact on Spanish football. We looked at Hamburg's latest setback. We covered Sampdoria's silver linings, and we analysed Habib Diarra's emergence as one of the brightest young talents in Ligue 1. We looked at all of those topics and so much more in our usual detailed way. This episode is of course produced in partnership with Freelance Football Ops. If any of our listeners are freelancing in football, you may be interested in signing up to Freelance Football Ops subscription-based newsletter. They find jobs which cover writing, design, video, audio, and generally anything in football media every week. For more info, visit freelancefootballops.com or follow at FFOps on Twitter. Just some brief housekeeping. This is the final episode of the fourth season of the podcast. We'll be back for season 5 of the Road to Nowhere European Football Podcast when the domestic seasons start towards the end of the summer. That will, of course, be here before we all know it. But yeah, we just wanted to say, and we reiterate this in the episode, but we just wanted to say thank you to all of you for your continued support. If you don't already do so, please do consider subscribing to the podcast to make sure that you're the first to hear about, or rather you're the first to receive, the first episode of season 5 when that lands later in the summer. And also, if you've not already done so, please do consider sharing the podcast with a family member, with a friend of yours. And also, I know that we're asking a lot here, but if you could consider leaving us a brief review, that would again be extremely appreciated. All of those steps would help the podcast to grow even more. We would be even more grateful than we currently already are. As an aside, you might hear slightly more background noise during this episode than you perhaps usually would, and I must apologise for that. It's a rather warm evening in Glasgow, and so I did have the windows open to try and get some fresh air into the flat, and as a result, yeah, there may be some more background noise than would usually be the case, but hopefully that's not too off-putting for you. Okay, with the housekeeping out the way, I will now let the episode take centre stage. Hopefully you learn a thing or two, or perhaps even three. Enjoy. I was actually about to finalise the podcast when I realised that I had neglected to mention some really exciting news from our friends at Scouted Football. They are back. Well, they were never really away, what with the excellent Scouted Football podcast, but they are back with their printed publication. You might remember the Scouted Handbook. Well, they are back after a hiatus of sorts. They are back. They are launching Scouted 001. So, yeah, really exciting times for Scouted Football and their printed publication. So yeah, do go and check them out at ScoutedFTBL on Twitter, or if you head to scoutedftbl.com for their website, and if you click on the magazine link on the homepage of that website, that will tell you all you need to know about this exciting project from our friends at Scouted Football. Anyway, I will now let the episode take centre stage. Thanks again. Well, for one final time this season, you're listening To the Road to Nowhere European Football Podcast. It is another glorious evening in Glasgow. Michael Jones, I'm not quite sure how the weather is for you down in Manchester. Is it as sunny in Manchester as it is in Glasgow?
I don't actually know. I mean, it was sunny earlier, but I'm in the office still at the moment, and I keep the shutters down when I'm the only one in my office, just because, you know, based in Salford and all that, and you just never know who's around the corner. But I used to live in Salford, for what it's worth. But yeah, I'll find out shortly after we finish recording. But I think it's pretty sunny. How are you doing anyway?
Yeah, I'm very well, thanks, Michael. Very well, thank you. It's been a good few weeks, and I'm looking forward to presenting our end of season awards. This, of course, our last episode for a while. We'll be back at the start of next season. But yeah, this is our finale for the 2022-2023 campaign. And yeah, it's our now traditional, I suppose you could say, end of season awards. Now we're going to start with Germany, Michael. I've split my sort of awards into three. I'm going to hand out the Lifetime Achievement Award for Services to Entertainment. I'm going to hand out the Merit Award for Trying but Ultimately Failing. And I'm also going to hand out the Road to Nowhere Bundesliga Cult Hero Award. So just looking at the first of those three awards, I think this one probably, yeah, a unanimous verdict in the sense that we're going to hand the Lifetime Achievement Award for Services to Entertainment to Hamburg and specifically their supporters. Now, Michael, you probably would have seen what unfolded with the Hamburg fans thinking that they had sealed automatic promotion due to their win over Sandhausen. Their fans thought, that's enough. We've done enough to secure automatic promotion back to the Bundesliga's top flight. They invaded the pitch, and I think even the stadium announcer said congratulations to Hamburg on their return to the top flight. And yet Heidenheim, they were needing a sort of Man City-esque turn of events to secure automatic promotion at Hamburg's expense. And well, secure automatic promotion at Hamburg's expense they did. They scored an equaliser at Jans Regensburg before going on to score a late winner, much to the dismay of the Hamburg fans, the Hamburg players. And yeah, really quite something. I think for any team, that would be really difficult to stomach. But for Hamburg in particular, when you think of all they've gone through, they of course lost a playoff last season. And this result, this rather unfortunate turn of events, confined Hamburg to another, or rather consigned Hamburg to another playoff place rather than automatic promotion. They, of course, went on to go and play Stuttgart. We know how that one unfolded. It was a landslide victory for a Ciro Gyurassy-inspired Stuttgart. And yeah, Hamburg once again will be playing second-tier football next season. It is, on the one hand, a shame, Michael, because Hamburg are a fantastic club with a rich history, great tradition, and one of the heavyweight powers of German football. But on the other hand, there is sort of that element of Schadenfreude, as the Germans say. I've perhaps butchered the pronunciation there. Barlow can correct me later, no doubt. But there is that element of sort of, yeah, joy at the expense of somebody else's pain, somebody else's suffering, somebody else's misery. And yeah, the Hamburg fans for, yeah, being a little bit too eager to celebrate, for celebrating a little bit prematurely. This was really one of the stories of the season across European football. Those images of the Hamburg fans, I think some of them had even started to dig up the turf, and yet those celebrations were cut quite brutally short when events unfolded elsewhere, which meant that Hamburg had to make do with a playoff spot. And yeah, that playoff unfolded in rather unfortunate fashion as well, an absolute doing at the hands of Stuttgart. So yeah, the Lifetime Achievement Award for Services to Entertainment goes to Hamburg and their supporters. Hopefully next season they can perhaps get up into the top flight, although the way that things have been going with Hamburg recently, ever since they dropped out of the top flight, I wouldn't be too convinced that they can manage such a feat. Okay, next up, another award which goes to a traditional heavyweight of German football. It's the Merit Award for trying but ultimately failing. And I think the reason I thought it would be appropriate to dish out this award is I remember when I was in secondary school, I was given a Merit Award for music, and I think it was because I tried hard, but despite my wonderful rendition of A Flower of Scotland on the xylophone, I was never really musically gifted, Michael. But nevertheless, I was given a Merit Award because I put my heart and soul into that rendition of A Flower of Scotland. And Schalke, certainly in the second half of the season, put their heart and soul into trying to prolong their return to the Bundesliga, and yet it was all in vain. Now, first half of the season, I think they only mustered something like 9 points. It was a ridiculously poor first half of the season, and yet after the World Cup, they went on some sort of run. You might remember, Michael, we mentioned that run of 4-0 draws in a row, that sort of form which was up there with Borussia Dortmund in terms of an unbeaten run, and that form which gave them a slither of hope that they could avoid the drop, and yet ultimately that was all in vain. They had a really difficult fixture list towards the end of the season, and yeah, they ultimately ended up suffering automatic relegation. Only Hertha Berlin performed worse than Schalke over the course of the season, and that really doesn't say too much for Schalke. Hertha Berlin, just an absolute calamity at the moment on and off the field of play. So yeah, the kind of the Merit Award for trying but ultimately failing goes to Schalke. Certainly in the second half of the season, Michael, no lack of grit, no lack of determination, no lack of effort. Thomas Reiss really sort of galvanised this Schalke team. There were some memorable moments, some memorable late winners, for example. But yeah, all of that turns out it was all in vain, because it's going to be another season in the second tier of German football. So you're going to have the likes of Schalke and Hamburg and Hertha Berlin battling it out in the Zweite Liga next season. Which on the one hand, yeah, that's good for the second tier. It brings some big names. It brings some traditional heavyweights to the second tier. In Hamburg's case, it keeps them there. But on the other hand, I think it is a loss for the Bundesliga. It is a loss for the top flight not to have the likes of Schalke, Hamburg or Hertha Berlin playing in that top flight. Finally, Michael, the Road to Nowhere Bundesliga Cult Hero Award. I've decided to give this one to, not to a player, but to a manager in Urs Fischer, who of course guided Union Berlin to the Champions League. I think that is arguably one of the best stories of the season across the top five leagues, across the four leagues that we predominantly cover. I think there is a lot of chat, Michael, about Union Berlin, but quite often, and not that this happens all the time, but quite often we seem to almost forget to credit Urs Fischer. We forget to give him his flowers. You think about the route that he's taken to, well, almost the top, I suppose. You could argue that securing Champions League football is making it at the top. But it's not been the sort of natural route that some managers would take. He's had to bide his time. He, of course, took over Union Berlin when they were in the second tier. He brought them up for the first time in their history to the Bundesliga, and season on season they've made progress, they've made gains, they of course secured their survival the first season up, then they made the Conference League, then they made the Europa League, and now they've made the Champions League, and you do have to wonder where exactly their ceiling would be. But yeah, I think we do have to give Urs Fischer his flowers. I think his style of man management, his style of knowing what he wants and getting what he wants in terms of recruitment, in terms of output from the players that he picks for his starting 11, the substitutes that he brings on. I think, yeah, we do really have to give Urs Fischer his flowers. And there's something about Fischer which I find a little bit inimitable. I think you don't get too many managers cut from the same cloth, shall we say, as Urs Fischer across Europe's top five leagues these days. And yeah, he's a real positive presence for the Bundesliga. So yeah, for that reason, I'm going to give Fischer the Road to Nowhere Bundesliga Cult Hero Award, and I'm going to look forward to seeing Champions League football perhaps at the Stadion an der Alter Försterei next season. Maybe UEFA's top bosses will say, no, you can't play football there, you have to play at the Olympiastadion, which I think would be a shame. I think Union Berlin would quite readily fill the Olympia Stadion, 70-odd thousand seats, 80-odd thousand seats. But I think there would be something magical about watching Champions League football under the floodlights at the Stadion and out there for Sarai. Okay, I think that wraps up our German awards there. I feel like I butchered a couple of the pronunciations there, Michael. Some of my German pronunciations not quite as up to scratch as some of my French pronunciations, but yeah, I gave it a good shot, and in that regard, perhaps I'll earn a merit award for my German language skills. Okay, we are going to take a quick break. We're going to dial in Rory Barlow, who is going to speak to Michael about the end of season awards for Italian football and Serie A. We'll be right back.
I'm joined by the intrepid Italian football expert, Michael Jones, who is, I think it's fair to say, like much of the news corporations and many of the sports media, thankful that there will be a break coming soon. But we have enjoyed the season terrifically, and especially in Serie A, which has been a great year for Italian clubs, especially in Europe. It's our awards show. Welcome to the gala night. What are you wearing, Michael?
Yeah, tonight I'm just wearing a sort of salmony pink shirt, which I guess has a bit of a continental feel for it ahead of some continental action this week involving Italian teams. We've got, obviously, I think the result will know, everyone will know the result by the time the podcast is out, but Fiorentina West Ham tomorrow in the Conference League final, which I think is a really tasty matchup. And then, of course, the big one on Saturday, which is Inter Milan versus Manchester City, and all the focus, you know, at least where I am in Manchester, where, you know, is obviously on Manchester City. But I think there's a real, I think there's cause for a real sense of excitement and unpredictability to this Inter Milan team. I don't think there's a single team on the continent that plays in a similar system to them whatsoever with the type of technical players that they have. So it's going to be hard for Manchester City to prepare. And I'm really excited to see how this game unfolds. And I can kind of see it's one of those games which you particularly look forward to a bit more because you can almost warm to either side winning. Okay, maybe not ethically for Manchester City for so many reasons, but having lived in the city and being around a lot of supporters and stuff, you know, for a team to win their first trophy is quite, you know, obviously it's the pinnacle and it would be really incredible, especially for it to be here in Manchester. But for Inter Milan, against all odds in many ways, both in the group that they started with at the start of the season and, you know, overcoming teams on their way to the final, albeit not the trickiest of runs, but certainly some tricky games, I think it's going to make for a really scintillating final. Watch that and it'll be 5-0 City. But yeah, how about you, Barlow? A particularly good European final for Sevilla over Roma. Hopefully the other Italian teams do a bit better and go out with a bit more grace as well.
Yeah, well, I don't think the second part will be too difficult. I mean, Jose is a man of, less said about it, the better. I'm just going to shut my mouth on that. But yeah, Sevilla, Mendilibar, I mean, yeah, I wish I'd, I think it was the last episode we were talking about Vinicius and the racism, which is a shame because I should have been previewing Mendilibar and his fantastic achievements, which I will, keep that to a minimum since we are in the Italy section. I'll come on to the awards. Felicidades to Mendy and his team and Sevilla for their seventh. But in Italy, the first award that you've given me here is the Ferrero Bocher or Botcher Award, depending on how you want to pronounce that. Tell us, Michael, what it is about and who has taken it.
Yeah, it's not actually as smooth a sounding as it is looking on paper. And it kind of relates to the chocolates. Obviously, many people are familiar with Ferrero Rocher, but there's also a lot of a mispronunciation of it as a Ferrero Rocher. So I've gone for the sort of rhyming botch element of that. And the owner award, this is for the worst owner in Serie A this season. And I think if you've listened to the podcast throughout the season, there's been one team and one story that's been a familiar tale throughout that, which is Juventus with Andrea Agnelli, but who left just before Christmas. But I do think that Juventus Can't really qualify for this because of a lot of the actions that took place, which led to the 10-point deduction that they received in the end. Obviously, initially 18 for those who, all of you, of course, listened to the previous episode. But I'm actually going to give this one to another guy who's done some serious long-term damage to a club, but it's all culminated this season, and that is Massimo Ferrero. Last year, he spent some time in prison, which we know in 2021 even, that we covered. And this year, kind of whereabouts in that sense has still been, I think he has spent time both in and out of prison this season. But in terms of, you know, that's always been a nasty, not a nice sight to have off the pitch. But Sampdoria have reflected that on the pitch this season. They finished the season with a meagre 17 points, which is a classic tale of a big club that has kind of been one rinsed of its assets. It's a club that was declared, the owner was declared bankrupt. Their relegation on 17 points is the joint lowest with Chievo Verona, who went down in 2019 on 17 points, which is the lowest points tally in the Serie A in the 20-team era since 2004, from the top of my head. But Chievo actually had a 3-point deduction. So Sampdoria have managed to really do something pretty bad this season. And when I watched them, I went to watch them versus Bologna, and you'll probably quickly see with these awards as a bit of a continuation from that. But when I went to watch them this season, I mean, the standard of football was pretty diabolical, but they did get a draw, and it was the first game under the new manager, Dejan Stankovic, at the time, a Serie A calcio legend, treble winner with Inter Milan. Jose Mourinho had good success. I think it was with Red Star Belgrade, might have been Partizan. I do get those. I might get that one mixed up. I'm pretty sure it's Red Star, though. He had a lot of coaching success in Serbia with them, and I think a lot was expected of him when he came to Italy. But he was given, you know, a bit of a shell of a squad, both in terms of the actual quality of players, but also the kind of profile, of recruitment strategy, and just general investment wasn't there. And Ferrero has utterly botched it. And fortunately for Sampdoria, who have got a points deduction going into next season for unpaid wages going into the end of this season, Andrea Radriazzani has taken over the club. Many are familiar with his role at Leeds. Looks like that the Leeds could even be sold by the time this podcast comes out on Friday to the 49ers consortium. But, you know, Ferrero has played such a pivotal role to their downfall. He had the chance to sell the club only just over a year ago to the late Gianluca Vialli, a consortium led by him, which failed very much at Ferrero's seemingly own doing. And now they're left in a place of a huge rebuilding job. I mean, Radriazzani, I think, will come in a good position. I think he has, you know, it's very rare that a team in Sampdoria's situation will get quite a proven club owner. Okay, it's not been the most graceful end to his time at Leeds United, with themselves getting relegated, but he has generally overseen quite a successful period at the club, you know, leading them into the Premier League for the first time in almost 20 years. So I think that, you know, with every cloud, there is a silver lining. And for certainly for Sampdoria, you hope that is the case. We're not going to get a Serie B matchup next season between themselves and Genoa. Famous local derby, of course. Genoa will be back in Serie A, so it's great to have the city having some form of representation. But Sampdoria, I heard James Horncastle say a few weeks ago on the European football show, the Totally One, that, you know, Sampdoria, for many people, partially because of their sort of English players that they've had over the past few decades, they've always been a sort of a second club, you know, their iconic strip, the successful team in the early 1990s. They've been a second club for many people, not just in Italy. And it's a real travesty that, you know, because of this shoddy ownership, that they found themselves in the position they are. I mean, they still do have English representation in the forms of Ronaldo, Vieira and Harry Winks, but Vieira's contract's up and Harry Winks, who was actually sold by Radriazzani to Leeds in the first place, and Harry Winks' loan be coming to an end. He'll be going back to Tottenham, although I'm not sure they'll be too impressed with him following this loan spell. But yeah, it's ultimately a huge rebuilding job for Sampdoria, and I really just hope people like Ferrero stay away from football. He did take the club over in 2014 and did buy out the debt at the time, and in some respects, you know, given he was the owner of the club for 9 years, there is a sense of, okay, well, there has been worse out there in some respects of club, you know, teams that have been bought out and literally owners have turned them bankrupt within 12 months. And okay, it's not been that bad. So you can maybe, there's maybe a little bit of understanding as to how he passed a sort of directors, owners and directors test in Italy at the time. But it just shows the sort of more rigorous need and also the costs of operating teams in Italy at the moment, where revenue is a real struggle for so many.
Yeah, sorry times at Sampdoria. Hopefully they will be back soon and under better management, and we'll have more Genoese clashes to look forward to. The next award is called the Maestro Calcio Trophy, and it's going to a player which I think has a place in many people's hearts, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, so this award was initially designed or designated for a player who I thought would be retiring, I thought should be retiring, and I'm still sure could be retiring, but I'm not entirely sure at the moment. Different headlines at the moment. I mean, one of those contenders could be Zlatan Ibrahimovic, and I definitely wasn't under the impression that Zlatan Ibrahimovic was going to continue playing, but I may have missed that slight announcement of him retiring. But I'm still not convinced he's retiring. I can see Ibrahimovic returning maybe for the next Swedish season or something.
You heard it here first.
Yeah, exactly. It's my exclusive and the one and only exclusive today. But apart from these awards, of course. But yeah, a player who I think people outside of Italy, even people who haven't followed this guy's career, hold really close to their hearts in the sense of what he's gone through during his career. And that's Fabio Quagliarella, guy who scored in 19 consecutive years in Italian football at the top flight, 18 consecutive seasons. Now, at the ripe old age of 40, is set to mark his, well, departure from the top of Serie A. And I think, you know, him playing a bit part role in a team that only got 17 points maybe is a fair demonstration of that, him knowing his level, knowing what he's capable of playing at the future. And despite, you know, Quagliarella had an incredible sort of goal scoring return up until really recently. It was only up until last season, as in 21-22, that he'd gone into single digits for the first time since 2016 in Serie A. He'd really rejuvenated his career at Sampdoria. He'd spent 8 years there, scored just under 100 goals in all competitions during his time. Most of them, almost all of them, in fact, coming in the league, had a horrific cup record during that time. But yeah, I mean, he's a guy who's been, he's such a familiar face through all the different eras we've seen Italian football go through, I guess, since they won the World Cup. You know, he was a shining light in the team, the Italy team, the World Cup holders, that got eliminated from the group stage of the 2010 World Cup, a group that contained Slovakia, Paraguay, and New Zealand. But he scored such a beautiful chip that I'm sure many people, it may have been the first time many people were even aware of who Quagliarella was outside of Italy at the time, a gorgeous chip over Slovakia, which didn't actually achieve much for Italy in that game or in the tournament. But aside from that, he's a player who has consistently scored for the bulk of his career, apart from quite a difficult spell that he did endure around the 2010 World Cup, yet still had these memorable moments. And that was because of a really famous case that he only came out and spoke about a few years later. He was spent one season at Napoli's boyhood club in 2009 to 2010, did score 11 goals, but was expected, I think it's fair to say, to do a lot more, didn't warm to the supporters, wasn't sort of seen to be that proud at the time, or that was the perception of him, and struggled under Conte at Juventus as well, as sort of a bit part player until finding his feet at Torino and Sampdoria again. But he did come to reveal this in a fascinating interview, which is one of the best interviews I think I've ever read with a footballer, and in terms of following the story, is told so beautifully. And I would certainly recommend, there's several different versions online now, but if you do go and read it. It's one of those ones that you can come back to and read again in a few years. It's kind of, you know, such a unique, strange story of what happened to him. But once the Napoli fans discovered that, there was this sort of beautiful moment where they took him back into the house. There were banners put up over a number of seasons, when, especially when he came to play there. And then the most fitting moment of all was the Sunday just gone, the last game of the season, and what's likely to be his last game in Serie A. He was substituted off a few minutes before the end. Sampdoria 2-0 down, bottom of the league versus top of the league away at Napoli. And everything just stopped. All the fans were on their feet applauding. The Italian striker, referee, was in no hurry whatsoever to sort of rush the ceremony. Everyone was in full adoration and admiration of what this guy's achieved in his career, what he's had to fight against in his career, the sort of mental health toll that he's bounced back from, a real story of resilience in sort of modern day football. And yeah, it was just such a beautiful send off. I think it was Adam Summerton on BT Sport. He was doing the commentary at the time. A really sort of lovely tribute from him as well, it has to be said. And he has since said that he plans to stay at Sampdoria and play in Serie B, which might, you know, work out okay for him. But I think there's no shame in him not achieving much more in his playing career, because I think his sort of legacy, let alone all the goals he scored, which has been a fantastic achievement, will probably last in fans and players and coaches' minds for so much longer than some trophies or some league titles or, you know, other things might matter. It's a really heartwarming story. And yeah, delighted to see the reception he got on Sunday.
I'm sure you're not alone in that sentiment, and hopefully Quagli Herrera, if he is retiring, does enjoy a long, restful and contented retirement. Moving on to the Capolista Compassion Cup, which I've been told, have been hinted from behind the gallery, is a heartwarming story. Michael, tell us what your final award is for and who it is going to.
Yeah, so this story is kind of, I mean, this award is kind of aimed at lead, you know, Capolista is about leadership, really. And it's why it translates as leaders, and it's the Leaders Compassion Cup, just with a bit of alliteration in there. But this is to Bologna. You know, we've just discussed a Sampdoria striker, discussed a Sampdoria owner, both for the right and wrong reasons, respectively. And seeing Sampdoria versus Bologna earlier in the season kind of has just steered all my attention onto those two teams. And it's been such a strange and difficult season for Bologna in some ways. And in other ways, they've been absolutely sensational in terms of what they've achieved. You know, they're a club that had done well, never were threatened by relegation over the past few seasons under the management of Sinisa Mihajlovic, a huge figure in football, both for his sort of playing career, his infamous free kicks, and, you know, his international success with what Yugoslavia was at the time in the 1998 World Cup and Euro 2000 in particular. And, you know, a player who also transitioned into coaching really well, but maybe found his biggest home at Bologna. And one of the reasons for that is not just the success he had and some of the players that he brought through during his time, but also that he battled leukemia numerous times whilst staying in the job, albeit obviously from a distant role at times. And Bologna always seemed to continue. They always seemed to be doing well. They always had such a good relationship with Mihajlovic. And then they found themselves at the start of this season in a really tricky position where by the start of September, they had made a dismal start to the season. And it was raising those questions, whether the relationship Sinisa Mihajlovic had, not just with the club, but with the owner, Joey Saputo, was going to be potentially tarnished if they were to carry on working together, and Saputo had to make a really difficult decision. But I must admit, it's one at the time, this was in September, it was one of the sort of most touching manager sacking statements I've seen. I remember Roman Abramovich maybe tried to do one for Frank Lampard, but that doesn't come remotely close in comparison. And yeah, I think they've said that, he said at the time that they'll always be by his side and for total recovery in the rest of his career. Obviously, little did they know that Mihailovic would die just a few months later. And for the Bologna players, many of whom played under him, that must have been a hugely difficult experience. But one of the shining lights is the season that they did have. I mean, there was huge tributes in their match between Bologna and Lazio earlier this year. Lazio, a team where Mihailovic had a really successful playing slash manager, no, playing career even then. And the family of Mihailovic turned up and they got to watch this really entertaining Thiago Motta team. I saw Motta in one of his first games at Bologna. We covered him for Spezia. He'd done a good job. Struggled at Genoa previously, but Motta has kind of grown in his last two roles exponentially, and he's been a fantastic coach for them and one to look a really bright future. He's been at heart some really important young players developing, the likes of Lewis Ferguson, who we discussed at length on the podcast. And, you know, for them to achieve a top 10 finish, bearing in mind that when they played Sampdoria, the game I went to in October, both teams were on, I think Bologna on about 6 points, Sampdoria on 3 in about 10 games, is an absolutely wonderful achievement. So Thiago Motta, I mean, I hope Bologna do keep hold of him for another season, because what he's not just done is, and what the team haven't just done is, you know, pick up results and pick up play, but they've also gone through what must have emotionally been a really difficult period. You saw the impacts that that's probably had on Antonio Conte during his spell at Tottenham Hotspur this season. And I think those kind of human factors should never really be underestimated in football. So, yeah, absolute hats off to Bologna. And a final tribute, I guess, to Sinisa Mihailovic, who such a, you know, a legend of the game and left a real legacy on calcio football in Italy too.
Yes, heartwarming and in some instances heartbreaking stories there from the north of Italy. But yeah, thank you very much for that. That was an interesting listen and a reminder of some of the kind of major events in Italy and Serie A this season. We'll be back in just a moment. We're going to take a very quick break and move on to España and La Liga.
Well, the tables have turned, and now it is my turn to ask Rudy Barlow for his unique Road to Nowhere awards. He has, of course, created the awards. Why would I do that? I don't have any knowledge of Spanish football compared to you, Barlow, but I'm really excited to hear what you've got to give. And award number one, the first award we have, is the most unlikely couple award. Spain is a place of passion and fire and emotion. But this one goes to two men who could retire happily in a villa by the sea together.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the kind of show where it pits couples together and puts them on an island is La Isla de las Tentaciones, the Isle of Temptation here in Spain. At home in the UK, it's called Love Island. I think there's a Love Island in Australia too. That takes place on the island of Mallorca at various locations, I am told, by inside sources and the internet. But the Love Island is really dedicated to Javier Aguirre and Vedat Muriqi of Real Mallorca, who are the most unlikely couple. Javier Aguirre is, I mean, I've done bits on him in the past. He is a foul-mouthed Mexican. He's your favourite uncle. He's a veteran. He's been around a bit. He does not mind making jokes and he does not care really what people think, to be honest. He tends to speak his mind pretty freely. And he's all the more enjoyable for it, it should be said. He's a terrific character to have in Spanish football. And Vedat Muriqi, who of course is kind of the man bun giant Kosovan forward, who at times in his career has not been prolific, but has certainly been for Mallorca, and yeah, Morici's stay in Mallorca essentially has been a love in itself, but particularly with Javier Aguirre. I mean, Morici arrived in Mallorca and made a big impact last season, and he was more or less the difference between keeping them up or not. He inspired them to safety alongside Aguirre, who came in, took the game, took the team with about seven games to go, and kept them up. And I mean, it shows you how much I know. I predicted Mallorca to go down this season, as did quite a lot of my colleagues at La Liga Lowdown. Morici and Aguirre were two of the big differences for Mallorca, who cruised to safety, finished 10th. I think it's their best finish in 8 years in La Liga. Goes to show just how well they've done, or 9th, sorry. And yeah, those two are a massive part of it. Morici, 14 goals, joint 5th top scorer in the division. He has had a fantastic season, it has to be said. And so is Javier Aguirre, who's turned this into a very kind of, going to go Spanglish here on you again, rocky team. They're very kind of hard to deal with. They're hard, and they're a little bit nasty, and they're a struggle for other teams to face. But yeah, these two kind of unlikely figures, they come from different parts of the world, from vastly different cultures and vastly kind of different walks of life. I mean, yeah, Morici grew up in Kosovo during the war and stuff, and he's spoken about that a lot this season, and it's been interesting to hear kind of his perspectives on that. But yeah, Aguirre said kind of in a press conference, I think it was pretty early on in the season, it was either October or November, he said, yeah, he's big. And given how ugly he is, he's not bad at football either, which pricked a few ears up in the Spanish media. And yeah, it was very much in character for Aguirre. And so, of course, next interview, this was put to Morici, who said, yeah, he's not wrong, but like, I think I've always had my niche with people as well. I've always had my appreciators for the kind of rugged Kosovan hero, I guess. And yeah, this kind of continued on going back and forth, and it came to around kind of February time, and Morici said, yeah, I mean, he keeps calling me ugly and keeps saying that I'm not too good looking, but he's not much of a looker himself, it has to be said. To which Aguirre then responded following press conference with, yeah, I mean, he's ugly, and to be fair, he's got a point, I'm not much of a looker myself. And so the two of them seem to, regardless of how they look, seem to have a great appreciation of each other. They are greatly appreciated in Mallorca. I think it's those two are two of the heroes of this Real Mallorca story, and it's been a good one this season. It's been one that's been enjoyable to watch and impressive from a point of view of resources. So yeah, full credit to Vedat Morici and Javier Aguirre for their wonderful showing this season, and may they live happily ever after.
Yeah, I mean, as soon as you told me about Aguirre sending you in that, the first thing I thought of was Aguirre himself, thinking, so fair play to Morici, particularly for that award. And I must admit, having watched Morici in Italy, I never thought he'd be winning any kind of, you know, positive award again in his career. So congrats to him for turning it around.
Impossible not to love that scoundrel was another of Aguirre's good phrases. I'll just get in there before we move on to the next award.
Absolutely. Well, I'm a vegetarian, in case people didn't know. So we're also going to move on to something else that I don't think is particularly attractive, which is a giant Spanish ham award. And this is, you know, anyone who has been on holiday to Spain, apart from me, obviously, will have seen the imposing Spanish legs of ham that hang in the supermarket, some of which can be spiraled into the hundreds of euros. There is one club that tends to give them out as a prize on match days, but this time it is they that deserve to dine in on their achievements for several months.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, personally, I also find those massive legs of ham quite intimidating, it has to be said. But Real Sociedad do raffle them off to the fans. And there's many a picture of giant leg of ham with fan, and also various players being pictured with ham advertising. One of their sponsors, I do believe, is part of the reason behind that. But yeah, they deserve the giant ham. They deserve the award because it's all more or less kind of come through the system at La Real, and it is all, I think it's about 13 of their players are from Guipúzcoa, which is the smallest province of Spain, and that's what they were saying on the Spanish football podcast. But in total, 18 of the 27 players they've used in the first team are players that have come through the academy, We've spoken about this before. We know just how well done. But in the meantime, since they have secured fourth spot, they've got that Champions League place. It's been vastly impressive from Imanol Aguathil. We, again, mentioned this during the course of the season. But fifth place finish, sixth place finish, fifth place, and now fourth. This is consistency on a level that La Real have not enjoyed in the 21st century. And it's really remarkably well done operation there. Given not only that, but the resources, the way they've used those resources. Alexander Isak exited for 70 million to Newcastle. I'm sure a lot of Premier League fans will be familiar with that. But their replacement, Umar Sadiq, came in for 25 million, tore his ACL after two games. And so they were essentially left without a kind of main striker this season, apart from Alexander Surlot, who did an excellent job in the end. He scored about 13, 14 goals in La Liga, which is impressive, but still you feel that they are kind of lacking a bit of a clinical striker amongst their ranks. And yeah, it's a testament just how well they play football and how well they've been doing all season. And yeah, I have to say hats off to Aguathil, hats off to La Real, and a couple of honourable mentions in here. Mendy for winning Europa League, as we mentioned in the last section. Michel at Girona has done a fantastic job. They finished 10th very, very well for themselves in their first season back from promotion. Osasuna, Iago Barrasate is the one that narrowly missed out on this award for coming 7th Conference League football. First time they've found European football in 16 years. And that Copa del Rey final appearance as well. And I guess we should probably say well done to Xavi and Barcelona for winning the league too. We'll move on now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, having Real Sociedad back competing amongst Europe's elite reminds me of that fantastic team they had in the early noughties, I believe it was. Nihat and Darko Kovacevic. I think that was a strike. Yeah, the one that almost pit Real Madrid to a league title. I swear it was goal difference or something insane like that on the last day. But fantastic to see them doing so well, especially with David Silva there as well for a Manchester reference. But our final award, probably somebody who does like giant Spanish ham, is the Kevin Malone Bad at Maths Award. This award has been shared between two different sides, and both of whom, again, spend all summer trying to show their work in. Those who added two twos and got five this season, Barlow. How do you explain that one?
Well, yeah, exactly. That is the question. I mean, I have questioned Real Valladolid's decision to sack Pacheta with kind of 7-8 games to go. They brought in Paulo Pezzolano, who did very well at Cruzeiro by all accounts in Brazil at Ronaldo Nazario's other club. Both phenomenal. The original Ronaldo is the owner at Valladolid, for those not aware. But they sacked Pacheta, who had them outside of the relegation zone by a point, and they finished inside the relegation zone by a point as well. And that doesn't mean to say that necessarily they would have stayed up under Pacheta, but it was a bold call at the time. Ultimately, it didn't come off. And certainly there's been a phrase doing the rounds in the Spanish media this week, which was Ronaldo 5 years ago, or 4 years ago, sorry, saying that in 5 years' time, we will be competing we're aiming to compete for European football, the Europa League, the Champions League. So yeah, that hasn't gone to plan for Ronaldo, and the maximum they can aspire to is just being back in the first division next season, or next year, sorry. And so, yeah, I mean, Ronaldo, I don't think he's done a dreadful job at Valladolid. Getting him back up immediately after promotion is something to be proud of. But two relegations in 3 years, it's been a theme since they came up that they kind of lacked a little bit of talent, it has to be said, front. And they invested this January, brought in Kyle Larin, Salim Amala from the Moroccan World Cup semi-finalist team, and Darwin Machis as well. And they had an impact, but it just felt a little bit too little too late for Valladolid, who ultimately went down against Getafe. Getafe, who did bring in somebody experienced. They brought in Pepe Bordalas, who absolutely shut out Valladolid in the last game. Valladolid, on the last day of the season, needed to win at home against Getafe, who were just a couple points above them. And they didn't get a single shot on target the entire game, which, I mean, you're throwing everything at this. This is your chance to survive at home. The atmosphere's good. Not really that impressive, especially when you brought in Pezzolano to kind of free up the attack a bit. So yeah, Ronaldo needs to do a little bit of work on his numbers and on his arithmetic, because it really did not come off for him there. And then there's Espanyol. The other one is Espanyol, who we know have been a bit of a disaster. We talked about them second. Diego Martinez, who we thought was the fresh new hope for Espanyol, the manager, that could bring them into kind of European contention. And it was going disastrously for them, but they again finished, I think it was ultimately 2 or 3 points off safety, but they were relegated with a game to go. Espanyol, when Luis García took over, were in the relegation zone, but only on goal difference. And if they had won their kind of repeat tie with Valencia, then they would have moved out of the relegation zone on head-to-head. So, yeah, they sacked a manager and they got worse. They brought in a manager who wasn't experienced, who was managing in the fourth or fifth tier, I believe. He was managing Real Madrid C. And he might turn out to be a good manager, but in the situation they were in with 7-8 games to go, it really was kind of an inexplicable decision, it has to be said, and one of several inexplicable decisions for Espanyol, who had one of the more talented squads in the kind of bottom half of the division. They had Hosselu, who scored 16 goals, I think it was, this season, still managed to go down. They had Sergi Darder, who's one of the best midfielders of La Liga this season, still managed to go down. And despite all that quality, they didn't strengthen the positions that they needed to. They really lacked at right back, and a lot of their goals kind of came through that region of the pitch. And so yeah, Domingo Catoira, the sporting director, I don't think he's too long for the job, to be perfectly honest. It's been a disastrous season for Espanyol, who had all of the resources, had everything they needed in place to be successful. And you can't pin it on one person or one particular thing. And nobody has really come out with too much credit apart from Darder and Hosselu. But yeah, it's not been a good season. So they have been left looking like the office idiot, with due respect to Kevin Malone and any office fans.
Yeah, maybe not as lovable at the moment. I do get that feeling, you know, when you say a manager will, they might turn out to be a good manager in the future. I think it's the percentages are normally quite slim for when that quote is said. But anyway, it would be good to see Espanyol bounce back. Yeah, Rudy Barlow, I will be joining Alistair for the other two sections this week, but this is over and out from you for the season. Have you got any summer plans?
That's a good question. I think I'm going to make it home eventually. I should be back on the island for hopefully just as lovely a time as Marici and Aguirre have been having in Mallorca. But yeah, back home to see some friends and family. And nothing too outrageous planned aside from that. Maybe a trip up north to Galicia is in the offing, though.
Sounds amazing. Well, yeah, thank you very much for all your work, I'm sure, on behalf of Alistair as well. And yeah, I believe we're moving on to the French section now. So yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, so it's back to Alistair Madden and I, and Alistair in particular, for the final section of the final episode of what's not the final season of the Road to Nowhere European Football Podcast. Yeah, over to you, Ali, and last but by no means least, League N, and the three awards that you've chosen for that league.
Yeah, Michael, I would just confirm that there will be more seasons of the podcast. Well, I'm intending for there to be more seasons. So yeah, do, on that note, subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already, just to make sure that when we do come back for season 5 at the start of next season, that, yeah, you are the first to listen to the podcast. You are the first to receive that new and juicy Road to Nowhere content ahead of the new season. But yeah, back to the here and now, Michael, and the end of season awards for Ligue 1. So the first award is the totally impartial, most exciting young player award. Now, Ligue 1, of course, markets itself quite rightly as the sort of the league of talents, Michael. There's an abundance of exciting young players coming through, and quite often Ligue 1 managers will afford plenty of game time to young players. I think we highlighted the sort of the scouted graphic, which mentioned the fact that Ligue 1 had afforded way more minutes to players under, I think, the age of 21 than any other top five league in Europe. So it is, yeah, the League of Talents. And there were plenty of exciting young players this time around. But as I've said, totally impartial, this award. I'm going to give it to Habib Diarra at Strasbourg. Now, Michael, I think your beloved Wolves are actually interested in young Habib Diarra, along with about half of the English top flight. So I'm not quite sure where he'll end up at the end of the summer transfer window. He will still be at Strasbourg, fingers crossed. He will still be at Strasbourg. But yeah, Habib Diarra, what a wonderful player, Michael. I've not been as excited about a young player for a long time as I have been about Habib Diarra. There's something about Diarra when he gets on the ball, when he takes a man on, he scores, particularly towards the end of the season, scored some really impressive goals, linked up beautifully with Habib Diallo, his almost namesake, not to be confused the two. But yeah, there was something special about Habib Diarra when Frederic Antonetti, the Strasbourg manager, placed that faith in him, pushed him further forward. You saw Diarra really come on to a brilliant game. I think earlier in the season, what we saw was Diarra playing in a much deeper role, quite often as a defensive midfielder. But latterly, you would see him in a sort of two tucked in behind Diallo. So you would have Diallo up front as a sort of spearhead. Then you would have Jean Rietner Bellegaard, another excellent player, sort of on the left side behind Diallo. Not quite a left winger, although sometimes he would be further out. But normally, he would be sort of tucked in a little bit and behind Diallo on the left, and then Diarra would be tucked in behind Diallo on the right. And yeah, that sort of front three, if we can call them that, really thrived together. Jean-Rietner Bellegaard, Habib Diallo and Habib Diarra. Now, such is football, such is modern football, that front three will probably be torn apart this summer. I'd be highly surprised to see Habib Diallo still at the Stade de la Meno come the end of the season. But I think, yeah, the spell of games that the three players had together really benefited all of them, and in particular benefited Habib Diarra. So if you've not been watching him, go and maybe have a look at some of his YouTube highlights. Pay attention to him next season if he's going to come to England. I don't think he's quite ready for that yet. I would think it would be most beneficial for his game if he were to stay in Ligue 1 with Strasbourg in particular and really develop his game, really polish certain aspects that are perhaps more raw within his skill set. But yeah, he's a joy to watch, Michael. The sort of player that gets you on your feet, the sort of player that you would happily pay the entry fee for just to see him on his own. Yeah, brilliant football player and a really exciting young talent, Habib Diarra at Strasbourg. The second award I'm going to dish out, Michael, is the Contrasting Fortunes Award, which I'm going to give to Nantes for reaching a second consecutive Coupe de France final and giving a, maybe not the best of Juventus sides in recent history, a run for the money, but still giving Juventus a run for their money in the Europa League. I think they drew in Turin before succumbing to a fairly straightforward defeat back at the Beaujoire. But yeah, so they reached two consecutive cup finals, gave Juventus a real run for the money, but almost suffered relegation, narrowly escaping relegation on the final day of the season. So the way it unfolded, Auxerre didn't get the result that they needed. Nantes did. They beat Angers, which was, of course, Nantes' first win, actually, in the league since mid-February. They went on a terrible run and, by all accounts, really should have been relegated based on that sort of final two or three months of the season. They really were poor, and particularly against Strasbourg, yeah, they really flattered to deceive, and they looked like a lost cause. So I think the fact that they've stayed up is a real positive for Ligue 1, in the same way that we were speaking earlier about the likes of Schalke going down. That's a real loss for the Bundesliga. Nantes going down would have been a real loss for Ligue 1. They've got arguably the best supporters in Ligue 1, maybe up there with the likes of Marseille, the likes of Lyon, the likes of Saint-Étienne. I know that they're in the second tier now, but also the likes of Strasbourg. So I think having Nantes in the top flight is a positive, but they do need to be more organised. They do need to be less calamitous than they were, certainly post-World Cup this season. I think, yeah, the atmosphere at the club is quite unsettled Ostensibly, anyway, that seems to be the case. Valdemir Keita's one of the more controversial decision makers, shall we say, in Ligue 1. And yeah, I think generally speaking, you've got a Nantes team there that yes, they've survived just about this season, but there needs to be huge improvements over the summer and going into next season if they are to avoid yet another really awkward season next time around. Finally, another Cult Hero Award. It's the Road to Nowhere League and Cult Hero Award. I'm going to give this one to Alexandre Lacazette. Now, there's something really pleasant for me anyway about a player coming back to a club at which he was once a legend, at which he once thrived. And upon his return, he then exceeds all expectations and arguably performs at an even higher level than he did first time around. And I think with Lacazette, that's what we saw. I think, Michael, you probably agree here. Lastly, at Arsenal, it's almost as if he lost all confidence. He just really struggled to score. I think he mustered 17 goals across two seasons, which for the quality of player that Lacazette is nowhere near the levels that we know he can produce. And yeah, he did seem like a shell of the player he once was latterly at the Emirates. And I think this move came at the right time. There was, to an extent, a feeling that perhaps against the backdrop of a sort of wider recruitment at Lyon over the summer, there was this feeling that Lacazette was maybe signed to appease a disgruntled fan base and that this was a move for old times' sake, a move motivated by nostalgia. But yeah, he was huge. One performance in particular stands out, and that was his four goals against Montpellier in what was arguably the best game across the top five leagues this season, that 5-4 win for Lyon against Montpellier, which kept alive their slight hopes of securing European football. Those hopes, of course, didn't materialise into actual European football. But yeah, that performance from Lacazette at the Groupama, there was something quite iconic, particularly about his 100th minute winner in that one, which I think summed up Lacazette's season on the whole. You know, a fantastic season. The fans definitely loved every moment of Lacazette's season, certainly seemed to be the case. And I think he played a key role in bringing on the likes of Ryan Cherki and Bradley Barcola, sort of young players. That sort of role model figure in Alex Lacazette was key for them, and Laurent Blanc as well. I think Blanc and Lacazette, if they're both going to be at Lyon next season, I think they'll have a key role to play, the two of them, in sort of, yeah, breathing the next crop of Lyon youngsters. There's no shortage of young players coming through at the Groupama Stadium. But I think Alex Lacazette has a key role to play both on the field of play and off the field of play. So yeah, for that reason, I'm going to give Alex Lacazette the Road to Nowhere League and Cult Hero Award, I suppose, for nostalgic purposes, but also to an extent for his goal-scoring exploits this season. Okay, well, with that, we will draw to a close the fourth season of the Road to Nowhere European Football Podcast. Thank you to Rudy Barlow and thank you to Michael Jones for once again contributing so much, both by way of research and yeah, insight to the podcast. Michael, thank you very much for your contributions this season.
No, thank you very much for having me, Ellie. I think it's another season. I'm not sure we maybe envisaged we'd be here as long as we have been already. And, you know, like we said, I think it's something that just seems to get better or gets more enjoyable each season and almost more comfortable. And, you know, following the leagues year upon year in the way that we do has built such an affinity with it as well. You know, I think it's been a difficult, largely since we started doing the podcast for Italian football, from my perspective, it's been a really underwhelming time in it for, you know, in one sense, domestically, you've had four different champions, which has been fantastic. But European, you know, continental competitiveness hasn't been there until this season, which has been, you know, really refreshing. And it's been a great sort of case where maybe people are a lot more familiar with Italian teams this season than they have been in the past. And long may it continue. And, you know, there's a good breed of coaches coming through at the moment, so I'm hoping there'll be a lot of excellent content for next season also.
Yeah, Michael, we will continue to follow the storylines. We will continue to put the narratives under the Road to Nowhere microscope, and we'll hopefully continue to provide you, the listener, with enlightening and entertaining content. On that note, I'll also say thank you to Rudy Barlow. In his absence, Rudy has been excellent once again in delivering all the latest news on Spanish football. And yeah, I will also say thank you to you, the listener. Please, if you've not already, do subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. And until the start of next season, which will be here, Michael, before we know it, it always comes around very quickly. But until then, Michael, until then, Barlow, and until then, the listener, stay safe and stay well. Goodbye.